Bonjour. Voilà, donc je suis heureux d'introduire l'exposé de Michael Schenker. Alors, bon, juste un petit mot sur l'organisation de ces deux heures. Exceptionnellement, comme il est venu de loin, on va lui réserver les deux heures, enfin pratiquement les deux heures entières, comme on avait fait pour Gabriel Vandenberg. Je vais présenter quelques documents, mais très brièvement au début, en un quart d'heure, parce qu'à mon avis, enfin, c'est pas de l'avis de tout le monde, mais ça a un certain rapport avec le thème de Rostam. Et l'exposé de Michael Schenker aura aussi un rapport très direct avec le thème de Rostam. Et puis on se gardera peut-être 20 minutes, un quart d'heure à la fin pour les discussions. Voilà, alors Michael Schenker est professeur associé à l'Université hébraïque de Jérusalem depuis 3 ans. Il a séjourné à Paris auparavant et en préparé sa thèse à l'École pratique des hautes études, donc sous ma co-direction. Sa thèse est parue en 2014 chez Brill. Je traduis le titre en français. Esprits intangibles et images gravées, l'iconographie des divinités zoroastriennes dans le monde iranien. Et c'est vraiment la somme de tout ce qui peut se dire maintenant sur les images qu'on peut identifier comme des divinités zoroastriennes. L'ouvrage a été préparé juste avant que le sujet ne rebondisse au Khwarezm avec les nouvelles découvertes de divinités peintes qui sont en fait les plus anciennes divinités zoroastriennes représentées vraiment avec leurs attributs sur au palais d'Akçakhankala. Voilà, donc aujourd'hui il va donc nous parler d'un sujet qui prolonge ce qui s'est dit au début, notamment avec moi, avec Gabriel Vandenberg, sur le thème, sur l'image et le cycle de Rostam sur les peintures de Penjikent, puisqu'il a identifié, de manière à mon avis tout à fait convaincante, un deuxième cycle d'aventure de Rostam, après le premier cycle qui était reconnu depuis longtemps, des aventures de Rostam avec les démons du Mazenderan. Alors, en préambule, je voudrais présenter quelques images, sur lesquelles actuellement je travaille, et qui, encore une fois, ont, à mon avis, un rapport avec le thème de Rostam. Alors, vous savez déjà, par ce qui a été dit au début, que le personnage de Rostam, on pensait qu'il était arrivé, il s'était introduit en Iran assez tardivement, donc depuis les épopées locales du Sistan, et assez tardivement, tout à fait à la fin de l'époque sassanide, parce qu'on n'a aucune attestation du nom Rostam dans l'onomastique sassanide avant cela. Alors, la piste sistanienne reste, à mon avis, valide, mais on remonte dans le temps, puisque maintenant, on a le nom Rostam en grec, Rostamos, sur un document en grec trouvé près du site de Doura Europos, document datant à peu près du milieu du 3e siècle, à un moment où Doura Europos est occupée par les Romains, mais visiblement remontante à cette tradition onomastique doit remonter à l'époque où la région était sous contrôle des Parthes. Et là, on remonte vraiment très, très tôt dans le temps. Alors, un second document a été trouvé hors contexte archéologique. Il est actuellement, donc c'est un plat sassanide qui est actuellement au musée Miho au Japon. Trouvé hors contexte, mais les meilleurs spécialistes de l'argenterie sassanide qui l'ont examiné, donc Prudence Harper, Meyers, s'accordent à considérer qu'il est authentique. Stylistiquement, Ça se date bien du 4e siècle de notre ère. Et c'est le style de l'objet appartient avec ce qu'on appelle le drapé à ligne ondulée continue. Parce qu'il y a deux tillets, il y a deux grandes catégories de plats royaux sassanides. Les plats à ligne couplée segmentée. Alors là, ça a l'air de. On les attribue plutôt à un atelier, à l'atelier royal, à l'atelier central, qui pouvait d'ailleurs itinérer avec la cour. Et le plat à ligne ondulée continue, qu'on attribue plutôt aux régions de l'Est. Bien. Alors, c'est du 4e siècle, et on voit donc un personnage qui maîtrise, en le tenant par le col, un cheval qui, à mon avis, en fait, est un poulain très robuste. Pourquoi un poulain plutôt qu'un cheval? Les chevaux sassanides ne sont pas bien grands. Hein. C'est comme les chevaux gaulois, ça devait faire 1m50 au garrot. En général, quand un cheval est représenté avec un roi sur un plat sassanide, ils ont exactement la même longueur, du nez à la croupe et la tête. Voilà. Et ici, il est un peu plus petit, hein, 5/6. Donc, on a un petit peu réduit les proportions. Je pense que c'est un poulain en train d'être dressé. Alors, on pense tout de suite à l'épisode relaté dans le Shahnameh de Rostam choisissant son cheval qui va l'accompagner toute sa carrière et qui va mourir avec lui d'ailleurs, Raksh, dans un troupeau, et c'est un poulain indompté. Et alors il le dompte avec un geste différent de ce qu'on voit ici, puisque il lui appuie sur le dos, c'est une technique apparemment bien connue. Il lui appuie sur le dos pour l'obliger à se courber et donc à être capable de recevoir un cavalier. Ici, le geste est un petit peu différent. Je pense malgré tout qu'il s'agit de Raksh. C'est d'ailleurs l'opinion qui a été présentée par le chercheur japonais qui est l'auteur de la seule publication qu'on a actuellement sur ce plat, Inagaki, un conservateur au musée Miho. Je pense que c'est Raksh, notamment à cause des couleurs, parce que Raksh est dans le Shahnameh et dans l'iconographie, dans toute l'iconographie d'ailleurs des manuscrits, et aussi dans l'iconographie de Penji Kent, est un cheval bai. Un cheval bai, c'est un cheval qui a une robe, disons, tirant sur le brun, mais avec le museau, le chanfrein et ce qu'on appelle les balzanes, c'est-à-dire le bas des pattes, blanc. Et c'est ce qu'on a voulu représenter ici, la couleur brune étant exprimée par la dorure. Et j'ai vérifié, sur toute la série des plats sassanides où on a des chevaux, il n'y en a pas un seul qui est représenté comme ça. Non, je pense qu'il s'agit de Raksh. Alors, s'agit-il de Rostam? Il a une couronne royale, mais d'un type absolument non attesté. C'est sûr, aucune monnaie, aucun plat sassanide ne montre ce type de couronne. Mon hypothèse, c'est que probablement il s'agit de Rostam, mais disons métaphoriquement, le personnage qui serait représenté serait un vice-roi sassanide d'une province orientale, alors on pense évidemment tout de suite au Sistan, il se trouve qu'on sait qu'il y a une série de Sagansha, roi des Sakas, roi du Sistan, appartenant à la famille royale sassanide. Le dernier est documenté par des inscriptions de Persépolis vers 320. C'est un membre de la famille royale. Après, on ne sait plus très bien, mais il y a dû y avoir encore des Sagansha sassanides. On ne sait pas quelle couronne ils avaient, parce que, sauf tout au début, ils n'émettent pas de monnaie. Donc, on ne sait pas les couronnes qu'ils avaient. Donc, ça pourrait très bien être l'un d'eux. On sait en tout cas que à la fin de l'époque sassanide, il n'y a plus de Sagansha au Sistan, mais il y a un Marsban, un gouverneur, et c'est une famille héréditaire, ils sont héréditaires, et ils ont le nom Rostam. Le dernier s'appelle Iran Ben Rostam, ou quelque chose comme ça. Donc, on a la preuve que ces gouverneurs locaux sassanides se revendiquent du héros national de la région. Et mon idée serait qu'il s'agit d'un vice-roi sassanide qui aurait voulu montrer qu'il était digne du héros national en accomplissant le même exploit. Bon, alors ça reste évidemment tout ça très hypothétique, mais en tout cas, c'est vraiment pas un plat ordinaire. Aucun plat sassanide ne figure ce type de sujet. Donc il faut bien trouver une explication. Alors, je vais passer rapidement à un autre document, là aussi, qui à mon avis n'est pas sans rapport avec le type de Rostam. J'avais donc signalé que, et Michael Schenker va revenir là-dessus aujourd'hui, que le type iconographique de Rostam dans la peinture de Penji Kent, celle exécutée vers 740, est un type très particulier. Ce n'est pas du tout le type physique habituel des chevaliers sogdiens. C'est un type ethniquement très marqué et qui est exactement le type physique des souverains heftalites qui régnaient 3-4 siècles plus tôt dans les régions au sud de l'Hindoukouche. L'idée qui est celle de Boris Marchak, c'est que on aurait cherché délibérément à se rattacher, enfin le type de Rostam. Rostam étant considéré comme un personnage frontalier qui a des origines étrangères, et donc il est le représentant de la dynastie du Sistan qui appartient à l'Iran sans tout à fait lui appartenir, qui n'est pas zoroastrien alors que l'Iran est devenu zoroastrien, etc. On aurait voulu délibérément l'assimiler à ces souverains qui autrefois avaient régné, non pas vraiment sur le Sistan, mais en tout cas sur le Zaboul, Kaboul, l'Arakozy, enfin les régions, disons, immédiatement à l'est du Sistan, jusqu'à Kaboul, dans le sud de l'Afghanistan actuel. On en est même à se demander, quand on voit la similitude, si les artistes sogdiens du 8e siècle n'ont pas carrément copié des monnaies. Parce que c'est exactement, les profils sont en fait superposables. Alors, le sujet a rebondi, en fait, disons, ce document à droite a été publié il y a assez longtemps, une vingtaine d'années, mais il fait l'objet actuellement de nouvelles discussions. Alors, c'est un document tout à fait extraordinaire. C'est un médaillon d'argent émis à Boukhara en 968 par un souverain de la dynastie des Samanides. Alors, les Samanides, on parle ici du livre des rois. Les Samanides sont, c'est le milieu dans lequel Ferdowsi a commencé sa carrière. Et c'est en fait, à la suite de la chute des Samanides en l'an 1000, que Ferdowsi s'est mis au service d'une nouvelle dynastie qui était la dynastie des Turcs de Ghazna. C'est Mansour Bennou, un des derniers souverains de la dynastie. Ce médaillon est à l'Ashmolean Museum d'Oxford. Il a été publié par Luke Treadwell. C'est quelque chose d'assez extraordinaire parce que la légende est Pélévi. Et sur la légende, on lit ici, c'est Huara Avzoud, donc la gloire royale, le charisme royal a augmenté. Légende typique des monnaies sassanides tardives. Et ici, Shahanshah, voilà, Shahanshah. Ça correspond à un moment très précis de retour nostalgique des anciennes titulatures et symboliques royales au milieu du 10e siècle, en concurrence avec la dynastie bouyide d'Iran, qui, au même moment, fait émet des médaillons du même type, avec exactement la même légende, il y a visiblement concurrence entre les deux dynasties, et un portrait royal, mais qui n'est pas celui-là. Le roi, le souverain Bouyide, est en fait vu de face, avec typiquement une couronne sassanide. On l'a représenté, on s'est inspiré des monnaies de Roslo II. Donc les Bouyides s'inscrivent délibérément dans la lignée sassanide. Et on sait d'ailleurs qu'ils s'étaient fait fabriquer une généalogie sassanide. Ils se posent en continuateur des sassanides. Voilà, ils sortaient d'ailleurs originellement d'un milieu zoroastrien du Tabaristan. On a la même légende. C'est selon Treadwell le même graveur qui a fait les deux médaillons. Mais là, c'est pas la même tête. C'est pas du tout comme ça qu'on s'attendait à trouver un roi samanide. Dans les images conventionnelles modernes d'Ismaïl Samani qu'a présenté Svetlana Gorchenina, c'est un type, disons, un type de héros conventionnel avec des traits un tout petit peu léninesques, typique de l'iconographie soviétique et post-soviétique. Ici, le visage est très marqué ethniquement, et évidemment, on pense à ce type iconographique qui a servi pour Rostam. Donc, on voit que, et alors en plus, il y a d'autres caractéristiques tout à fait inattendues, c'est que la couronne est vaguement dérivée de couronne sassanide, mais enfin ça pourrait être aussi des couronnes heftalites. Et il a ce qu'on voit qui pend dans le cou, on pourrait penser que c'est un ruban royal, mais ce n'est pas ça, c'est une tresse. Et la tresse dans le dos est caractéristique en fait des souverains turcs des siècles précédents. Et en réalité, le modèle de ce médaillon, comme celui du médaillon bouyide, ce sont des médaillons qu'on fait émettre des souverains turcs du Tokharestan, Bactriane, au début du 7e siècle. C'est vraiment, même l'inscription Pehlevi est copiée sur ces médaillons. À partir de là, on peut spéculer. Dernièrement, un historien ouzbek très nationaliste, Kamaleddinov, s'est beaucoup excité avec ce médaillon en disant « Mais voilà, les Samanides, en fait, on nous raconte partout, les Tadjiks nous disent que c'est les premiers Tadjiks, que c'est un empire iranien, nanana, mais pas du tout, c'était des bons Turcs, c'était déjà des Ouzbeks. » J'irai pas jusque-là, est-ce que le personnage a voulu se faire figurer à la turque? J'aurais plutôt tendance à penser qu'on a repris pour lui les traits d'une iconographie aristocratique, sogdienne, ayant des affinités avec les épopées du Sistan. Et donc, ce que j'avais tenté d'esquisser dans mon intervention au début du séminaire, peut-être, chez les Sogdiens, une sorte d'identité nationale de substitution. Les Sogdiens n'ont pas voulu se montrer véritablement comme des Sassanides. Ils ont été chercher leur modèle dans des épopées iraniennes de la frontière indo-iranienne, du Sistan. C'est-à-dire qu'il y aurait un sentiment de rattachement à autre chose. Cette autre chose, ça pourrait bien être les souvenirs de l'Empire heftalite du 5e, 6e siècle. Et on a l'impression que cette revendication de légitimité locale, pas véritablement, qui ne se réduit pas à l'Iran, se continue à travers les siècles. Il y a probablement eu des chaînons intermédiaires, nous ne les avons pas, mais on pourrait être amené à les découvrir. C'est pas Rostam, mais il y a un souvenir de l'imagerie pré-islamique de Rostam. Voilà, c'est ce que j'avais à dire. Et à présent, je vais passer la parole à Michael.
Merci beaucoup, Franz. Bonjour, je m'excuse de parler en anglais, donc c'est ma langue du travail. Mais après, bien sûr, vous pouvez poser votre question aussi en français, si vous voulez. OK. We're going to talk today about the Sogdian paintings. And before that, I would like to say a few words about what is Sogdian and what is Sogdiana. Sogdiana, and it's important to understand, is first of all a geographical term which refers to the region of modern Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, the valleys of rivers Zarafshan and Kashkadarya, which in this period were home to a unique Sogdian civilization. There was never a unified Sogdian state or Sogdian kingdom or Sogdian empire. Instead, in this period, we're talking about a complex network of independent or semi-independent states with complex relations between them. These cities were ruled by lords, but these lords were not absolute monarchs. Instead, their power and authority was checked and controlled by the powerful civic communities which existed in these cities, and the community is called Naf. Now, the Naf, as far as we can tell from our sources, in at least in several cities, it had the power to elect and to depose these lords. And these lords, for the most part, they failed to establish real dynasties and to pass their rulership to their sons. Now, one of the most important, at least from an archaeological point of view, Sogdian city-state, it was the city of Panjikent, located 60 kilometers to the east from Samarkand. Now, Panjikent is continuously excavated by the archaeological mission from the Hermitage Museum of St. Petersburg since 1947. It was founded in the 5th century, and the wall paintings uncovered in the city of Panjikent, which for the most part date from the first half of the 8th century, they are in fact the earliest illustrations of Iranian epos. Here you can see the city of Panjikent and the excavated areas, and you can see, of course, the excavated areas in the city. Yes. The most famous among these epic wall paintings from Panjikent is, of course, the Rostam room, or the Blue Hall, which contains the paintings depicting the exploits of Rustam, the great hero of the Shahnameh, the greatest Iranian hero. However, yes, and you can see, first of all, I understand that you have already discussed with Professor Grenet the paintings of the Rostam Hall. They were interpreted by Belenitsky and Marshak, the excavators of Panjikent. However, Along with the Rostam paintings, the archaeologists from Hermitage have discovered several other epic paintings, epic circles, but their exact subjects and possible connections with Iranian written epic tradition, they've remained unknown. And in this talk, I would like to suggest that one of these wall paintings, epic circles, found in room 50 in area 23, in fact, depict epic stories about hero Faramarz, the son of Rustam. Yes, you can see, first of all, several of these epic circles found in Penjikent, but which so far received no convincing interpretation. One of the earliest and most interesting epic paintings is this is this painting depicting a struggle between two armies, which we can identify and distinguish between them according to the shape of the hilt of their swords. One of them, they have this hilts in shape of dragon hands, and another army, they have the hilts in the shape of the circle. Another epic circle, epic paintings from Penjikent, which are not yet interpreted or identified, are these paintings. They are usually called the Amazon paintings because they depict a battle involving female warriors. Here you can see the painting. And here, I hope you can see a half-naked female warrior being apparently wounded, being carried away from the battlefield. Here, perhaps you can see it more clearly. Yeah. You can see that she's half-naked and wounded, perhaps dying already. And I'm showing you just a couple of pictures so you can also appreciate the style and the beauty of the Sogdian paintings. You can see the battle scene and the dying warriors lying beneath the hooves of horses. Usually, the faces of the dying or already dead Sogdian warriors are very calm. Sogdian artists never used to express excessive emotions in paintings, except for the figures of demons. And this is one of the characteristics of demons in Sogdian paintings, so that we can recognize them. But usually Sogdian warriors and heroes are completely calm, and you can only sense their agony and suffering because of the poses that they have. Right, here you can see it. Yes, the dying dead warriors. Okay, so we have a number of such epic cycles which we cannot interpret for the moment. What does it mean, interpret? It means to connect them with stories known from Persian-Iranian literary tradition. Well, the circle of paintings, which is a subject of my talk today, was discovered in room 50, in the vast household, a huge household apparently, more than 800 square meters, in the center of the city of Penjikent. It was excavated in 78-79. Yeah, it's here. Here you can see the reconstruction of a part of this really huge household, one of the biggest in the city, in Penjikent, and from this fact we can assume that it belonged to one of the wealthiest and most influential persons in the city, perhaps one of the leaders of the civic community. Now, the paintings were found here in this small rectangular room, number 50. The room is quite small. It's 7.2 meters long and 3.65 meters wide. Now, the paintings in the room, they date from 740. Then this household was being rebuilt after it was damaged it was damaged by fire in 722 during the Arabic conquest of Penjikent. In 1722, several houses, especially the wealthy houses in Penjikent, were damaged, and many of them were repaired. Then the inhabitants returned to Penjikent in 740, and this household is one of them. Now, due to it, usually in Penjikent we find paintings, and especially epic paintings, in the so-called reception halls. These reception halls have a very distinctive layout. They are square, and they have the roof of these rooms is supported by four columns, like the you can see here the room 49, which is the only one connected to room 50. In this case, it is very interesting that actually, the room 49, where we would expect to find paintings, this room was left unpainted, undecorated, and the paintings were made in this small side room 50. Now, Marshak, in his latest posthumous publication, suggested that this was because they try in 740, then the city of Penjikent was already ruled by the Arab emir, and the Arab garrison was situated on the citadel, so they tried to hide their paintings from the Arabs. But I do not find this explanation convincing, because in all other cases we find paintings in the big reception room without any problems. I think that what actually that the probable explanation for the unusual location of these paintings is that this room was intended to serve a very specific purpose. For example, the guests of the household owner were received first of all in the main reception hall. There they had a banquet. And on special occasions, after the banquet, a limited circle of guests could be invited to attend, to proceed to this small room 50. there they were entertained with a declamation of epic poetry. This is the tradition of declamation of epic of reciting the epic poetry is still very much alive in Iran, and it's an important part of Iranian culture. It's called Nakkali, and you can see here the picture of modern Nakkal, narrator, during the traditional performance of the reciting of the Shahnameh, and you can see that he recites the poetry, the epic, by heart, while pointing on the painted walls behind him. And the paintings on usually such performances take place in coffee houses and tea houses, and such the wall paintings, they serve as a decoration for the declamation of this epic poetry. And I think that this is exactly the purpose of room 15, and this is exactly what happened there. Okay, so now let us see the paintings themselves. First of all, well, I warn you, it will be a little bit boring, because we must describe the paintings and make a very sharp separation between the description of what we actually see and our own interpretation. I believe it is the most important thing to do when you work with iconography, and especially with paintings. And eventually, it helps to understand a lot of details afterwards if you, first of all, make a very detailed and boring description. Okay, so the fragments of the paintings were preserved on all four walls. This is quite exceptional for Penjikent. Usually we don't have such good preservation of paintings. Most of them were taken down in 79 and transported to the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. They are currently kept. The paintings of the Western Wall, and you see the drawings, are currently exhibited in the National Museum, in the new National Museum of Tajikistan in the, Dushanbe. Unfortunately, only some parts of these paintings were completely restored, and some of them still await the clearing and restoration process, which will undoubtedly reveal more details. The paintings were framed by a sculptured relief, which you do not see here, and it was not really well documented. And this relief originally displayed floral motifs. And the paintings covered the entire surface between these two friezes. The background of the paintings was blue. We will see it later. But it has blackened since then. Now, the paintings on the wall are divided in two main registers: the upper register and the lower one. Unusually for Penjikent paintings, these registers are not separated by border, like, for example, we can see in the Rustam room. I think that it means that, again, unlike what we see in Rustam hall, where the story of Rustam occupies only one register, and the upper register above Rustam apparently depicts another story, here This absence of clear border means that both registers were part of a single story. Now, the direction, the painting goes in boustrophedon. What does it mean? The upper register, in the upper register, the story evolves from left to right. It goes all over the room. And then it descends, it goes down, and in the lower register, it goes from right, the direction is from right to left. Now let us, and this painting is one really of the best of the best preserved among the paintings in Pinji Kent. All four walls are painted and preserved. One wall, the northern wall, was occupied, very typical and characteristic for Pinji Kent. It was occupied by a large image of the goddess Nana, the patron deity of the city. So the epic was basically limited to three walls only, except for the northern wall. Now let us try and understand what do we see here. In the upper register, I will show you later close-up pictures, but it's important first of all to see the whole wall. In the upper part, which is of course much more damaged, we can see a battle between mounted Sogdian warriors and half-naked people. They have ugly, repulsive faces. Yeah, here you can see. The western wall where the story begins in the upper part. Here is the detail of the mounted warriors in the upper register engaged in battle against these half-naked people. One of them, of the adversaries, the best preserved, is here, dying below the hooves of the horses. Now, these characters are half-naked, as I said. They have ugly, repulsive facial features. Some of them are riding wild animals. In several places, we have their legs preserved. One of them is riding a tiger or a lion. Another one is riding a bear. It is very important they are not demons, because demons are not depicted like that in the Sogdian paintings. Demons usually have animal traits in their appearance, like horns or wings or hooves. This is not it. It's some kind of wild man. And the battle apparently occupies the entire upper register, because we see the same scenes on all three walls in the room. The story then goes down to the lower register, here. And first of all, we see, I'm showing you drawings and not the actual photographs, because it's much easier to see on the drawings. On photographs themselves, it's quite difficult, and you do not see them with your own eyes. First of all, we see two horsemen approaching. They are mounted on red horses. It is an important detail. In the next scene, we see one of these horsemen on the red horse actually chasing a girl mounted on a black horse. The girl wears a very rich and elaborate dress. She has a nimbus around her head. She holds a kind of some shafted object in her hand, probably a scepter or maybe an axe. The reins of her horse are held by a strange and monstrous character. This character it has three heads, nimbus, four arms, rides a chariot drawn by wild boars. He holds a trident and a mace, and he holds the reins of the girl's horse, like leading her. And this character, who is the main character of our story, is chasing the girl. Here you can see the original, and you can see that it's very difficult to see the details. The demon, this character, the monstrous character, is white, which is also quite interesting. And here you can see the photographs. And you can also see that, I hope that you can, his three heads, the main one with the helmet. And here you have kind of monstrous head with a hair standing, and here another head with standing hair and the nimbus and the trident. Now we proceed to the next scene, which is the central scene of this wall. The hero who was chasing the monstrous character and the girl finally gets them, and they are engaged in a struggle. Here, the Sogdian artist chose, maybe the drawing will be better, yeah. You can see much more details. The Sogdian artist here chose to show us the culmination of their battle, of their single combat. Then probably they've already fought with several weapons. And now the hero, in a very dramatic way, you can see, catches the helmet of this monstrous character in order to cast him down from his chariot. Now the demon of the monstrous character desperately tries to strike him with his mace, but again, this, I think that the artist here succeeds in a very convincing way to convey us all the dramatism of the struggle, and we can see that it is desperate, and it's already lost. He can do nothing. He will be cast down by the powerful hero. His other part of the body is not preserved, so maybe originally he was holding a weapon, perhaps an axe, which we will see in the next scene. Now, then this character was first discovered in 78. The excavators Marshak and Belenitsky thought that it was that this was the Sogdian god Deshparkar, because there are some clear iconographic traces which are known from Deshparkar, like three heads and trident. But later, then then they saw other details, like the fact that all three heads of this monstrous character from the paintings are hideous and ugly and demonic, which is not the case with Vesh Parkar. So they immediately changed this interpretation, and we will get to it later. On the next scene, we see the wrestling between the hero and this monster. They are wrestling without weapons. They have already fought with weapons. Here you can see X, for example. And here is the girl who is now, who has dismounted and who is now observing the fight from a distance. It is an interesting detail, and we will get to it later, that here she does not have the nimbus. And the hero and the monster, they are wrestling. This is a very common and well-known motif from the epic and legendary tradition of the people of the Eurasian steppes, the Iranians and the Turks and the Mongols and Russians. Then the single combat between a hero and his adversary culminates in wrestling without without weapons, and this is the ultimate way for the hero to demonstrate his heroism and power. And the final scene on this room, we can see this poor creature already defeated. He has been stripped of all his weapons and armor, which is now stored in his chariot. And he's being stabbed with a dagger by the hero in his belly. I hope that you can hear. He is already half naked. And in this scene, he's also depicted already without his nimbus. Now the story passes to the southern wall. Here, on the in the upper register, as I've mentioned already, you can see again what remains of the battle between the mounted knights and this wild people. First of all, we see this scene. Our hero, identified by his armor and his most important attribute from now on, the girl, who has the same clothes, and this is how we can also recognize her. The hero kneels and make a gesture of blessing before a large and imposing character mounted on the red horse. Not much is preserved from this character, but the most important thing is preserved. And these are traces of his garments, which is actually a leopard skin garment. Important, interesting detail is the small mountain separating between them. Next, we see a procession of an army loaded with trophies. They are carrying weapons and quivers and bows. And we see also the procession of mounted warriors. Yeah, you can see the original piece from this wall, the one which has been restored in the Hermitage Museum. And you can see the Sogdian Knights. And then the last wall, the story terminates on the eastern wall. Two horsemen mounted on red horses approach, one horse is markedly bigger than the other. Although little is preserved, there can be no doubt that this is actually the main hero of our story. Next, we see a group of standing men led by a large figure. Again, his head is not preserved, but we don't need his head to recognize him, because we have because he wears a distinctive leopard skin garment, and he's bigger than the others. And he stands in front of what appears to be a royal tent, because inside we see a very interesting image of the king, which we'll discuss in details later. And before the king, we have our hero kneeling with a gesture of blessing or greeting or benediction. It is very interesting that here he changed his clothes. He's not wearing armor anymore, but he's wearing a type of courtly dress. But we can still recognize without a doubt that this is the main hero, because of the same girl that accompanies him. Here you can see the drawings. Actually, there is an interesting detail that I don't know how to interpret. I have a feeling that it must have a particular meaning, but I have no clue about it. What is going on here? You can see the hero's sword. The girl standing, kneeling behind, puts her hand on hero's sword, and he kind of covers her hand with his hand. What does this particular gesture mean? I don't know. We can only speculate that perhaps it represents kind of marriage, that she belongs to him, or that she was rescued by the power of his sword and by the virtue of his military might. But this is a very curious and particular gesture here. Behind the king, you can see two weapon bearers. It's also a very interesting detail. The king is seated between the cushions on a broad throne, supported by three figures of elephants. One support here is not visible, because it is covered by trophies laid before the throne of the king. You can see the helmet, and you can see the armor here. And I'm showing you the originals of this scene, which was also very well restored by the Hermitage museums. Here it is. And after this royal tent, you can see a row of other richly dressed characters standing and turned into the direction of the royal tent. And this is the end, more or less, of the story. Below this composition, here you see we have a border, the lower register, and there also was a narrow register representing running animals, which are purely decorative and are not related to the main story in any case. Now, when we've concluded this boring but necessary description, we can get to the interpretation. The preservation of the wall paintings in this room is most exceptional in Penjikent, and it virtually allows the reconstruction of the entire narrative. While the upper register, it's also interesting, depicted one single scene, the lower register represented, as we have seen, separate stories or separate episodes of the same story. The main theme and subject of the events seems completely clear. Let us go to the beginning. Now with the interpretation. A hero pursues a girl which has been captured and led into captivity by a monster, by a three-headed demon, apparently, because his iconography, as I've mentioned already, is remarkably close to the iconography of Fesh Parkar. He was first mistaken, but then in 79 the whole paintings were exposed. It became absolutely clear that this character is a demon, perhaps a king of the demons. His likeness to Vesh Parkar is due to the fact that the visual representation of both characters incorporates elements coming from Indian iconography, multiple heads, multiple hands, and a trident, which are attributes of an Indian god Shiva. And the boars harnessed to his chariot are reminiscent of Varaha, the avatar of Vishnu. So this is where this likeness between our demon and Vesh Parkar comes from. In the two following scenes, the hero defeats the demon while the girl watches. Yeah. Here it is, and here you can see Vesh Parkar, and you can see clearly the differences between them. And next, the hero and the girl is greeted by this character, who is undoubtedly Rustam, because of the color of his horse, the red horse Rakhsh, and his particular leopard skin garment. Here he is. Next, see the army, the victorious army, returning after victory with trophies, and this is how we understand that the hero was accompanied by the army. And in the final episode, our hero with his girl arrives at the court of the king, and Rustam is also present there, and this is how they know that the king is actually the king from a Persian epic. He could be Khosrow, for example. I think he is, and we will see it later. Now, despite the presence of Rustam, which is our anchor here in this story, and the obvious epic nature of the story, it was immediately recognized already by Belinitsky, who was a great connoisseur of Persian literature and poetry, that our paintings do not correspond to any episode involving Rustam, which are known from Shahnameh. In the excavation report of 79, Belinitsky cautiously suggested that most fitting story appears to be Bijan and Manijé, but you can see that he was never convinced by himself, and it doesn't correspond. And later he even rejected this interpretation and wrote that this is a story illustrating unknown Sogdian epic. Now, Marshak interpreted, tried to suggested to interpret these paintings as depicting the story of Rustam's daughter, saved by an unknown hero. Now, Rustam, as you know, had two daughters, at least. One is the more famous Banu Gushasp, who has her own epic. But in this epic of Banu Gushasp, there is nothing that corresponds to what we see here. So Marshak suggested that it could be a story about Rustam's second daughter, Zarbanu, about which we know virtually nothing, and because there is no name dedicated to her. I tried to go into another direction. Marshak always thought that the girl is related to Rustam, and my idea was that it was in fact the hero related who was related to Rustam, and I would like to suggest that these paintings in fact are in fact taken from the epic stories about Rustam's son Faramarz. More specifically, they illustrate his campaigns on the Indian islands, his battles against strange inhabitants of these islands, the story about his rescue of a daughter of an island called Kahila, who was abducted by a demon, and his marriage to her, and his triumphal return to Iran, where he is greeted by his father Rustam and by his ultimate sovereign Khosrow, who grants Faramarz the Indian kingship. I should have shown you this slide earlier with unrecognized, where I talked about unrecognized epic paintings. But what we see here is a fragment of yet another Sogdian epic paintings from another household in Penjikent. And what is remarkable here is again the depiction of Rustam in worship before these three incense burners. The story is distinctly epic, but it's very fragmentary and it remained unrecognized. So Rustam features prominently in most of Sogdian paintings from Penjikent. But let us now go back to Faramarz. Faramarz, who is a little bit overshadowed by Rustam's more famous son, Sohrab, Faramarz appears in the Shahnameh as a secondary character who takes part in his father's campaigns and assumes the command of the Sistani army after Rustam's death. It is only in the so-called Persian epic cycle or the later epics, and more specifically in two particular epics called the longer and the shorter Faramarznameh, where Faramarz emerged as the hero in his own right, acquiring great popularity comparing to that of Rustam himself. These later epics, and Professor Vandenberg here talked a lot about them, so I will only say a few words about them. There are a number of poems composed by anonymous authors between 11th and 14th century in New Persian in emulation of the Shahnameh, whose internal rhyme and matter they follow and try to emulate. Their plots are usually an offshoot of Ferdowsi's chef d'oeuvre, which we often seek to supplement, to tell, to elaborate on a story where Ferdowsi does not say much. They're usually considered late and secondary imitations, and they've long suffered from neglect from scholars of classical Persian, and even more so from the scholars of pre-Islamic Iranian history and literature, who considered only who concentrated only on the Shahnameh for the reconstruction of ancient Iranian myths, legends, and history. These later epics were considered late and crude imitations of Ferdowsi without any authentic pre-Islamic materials. So, and this is why there are very few they have not been for the most part critically edited. There are very few critical editions, and they haven't been translated into Western languages. But fortunately, in the last years, the situation appears to change. Dutch scholar Marjolein van Zutphen has recently produced a mastery study of figure of Farah Mars, first for her PhD dissertation, which appeared 2 years ago as a book, Farah Mars, the Sistani Hero, Texts and Traditions of the Farah Mars Nameh and the Persian Epic Circle. And there is another important book which has just came out of press by Mario Line. It is the translation of the large Farah Mars Nameh. Now, and this work, of course, greatly facilitated my own inquiry into the figure of Farah Mars, and it will be a basis for any future discussion of this later Persian epic. Now, Farah Mars was not included in the Chvadai Namag, a late Sasanian compendium of mythical and historical tradition, but he was incorporated in the epos of the Islamic period from the Sistanian epic circle. He is mentioned for the first time by Taburi in the 10th century, but stories about Farah Mars, like the stories about Rustam, most likely circulated already in the pre-Islamic period as part of epic circle about the Sistani heroes. This finds confirmation in the fact that the name Farah Mars, as Bramars, is attested in two Bactrian documents dated to the middle of the 7th century. So the name was there. And it indicates that probably the stories about Farah Mars were known in pre-Islamic Eastern Iranian world, even beyond the borders of Sistan. So it's very important evidence, this his name, which is attested as a personal name in Bactrian documents. Now, as I mentioned, Farah Mars does appear in the Shahnameh as a secondary character, where Kay Hosro dispatches him to conquer India. His adventure, and here basically Ferdowsi stops. But so we don't know what happened in India, and this is where the Farah Mars Nameh steps up. And these two poems, the shorter and the longer Farah Mars Nameh, tells us about his adventures at the head of a small army of Sistanian warriors. They travel to India, they sail around the Indian island, they battle against armies of humans and demons, they defeat kings, heroes, divs, and many fabulous creatures. They recover treasures deposited by the great Iranian kings of the past. He marries and rescues their princess, and is invested with Indian kingship by K. Khosrow. These poems were probably composed around in the 11th and towards the end of 11th century. This is the conclusion of Marjolein van Zupfen. Now, the Indian campaign is, of course, the main motif, and it occupied probably also important place in the original epic. Van Zupfen suggested that the figure of Faramarz was modeled on the Indo-Parthian king Gondophares, who was a ruler of Sistan in the first century and conquered regions in modern Afghanistan. And thus, according to her, the Indian campaign of Faramarz could reflect the epic redaction of the legendary stories about the exploits and conquests of Sistanians south of the Hindu Kush. It is an interesting suggestion, but of course, which cannot be verified. I think that all the scenes of the wall paintings from Book 50 can be interpreted based on the narrative of the longer Faramarz Nama. Let us go back from here. The upper register that depicts a battle against these people. They are not demons, as I mentioned, because this is not how the demons are usually depicted in Penji Kent. In both poems, Faramarz comes against savages who live on various Indian islands that are described as wild people who fight with stones and bones, but they are not demonic, and I think that since they are not demons, these wild people are exactly the ones described in the Faramarz Name, bizarre-looking inhabitants of the Indian islands, as they were imagined, of course, by the Sogdian painter. Now, the first episodes on the Western Wall, the beginning of the story, of course, this fight against these savagers, it forms a background of the story, and this is why it occupies the upper part of the register. Now, the first episode on the Western Wall depicts the events that take place on the island called Kahila, where Sistanians that Sistanians visit after sailing from mainland India. They are greeted and received by a local king and his court, but a certain unexpected event darkens their stay, because the daughter of the local king was captured by a demon while sleeping in the countryside. Faramarz, of course, volunteers immediately to rescue the girl. He chases the demon, battles him, kills him, and rescues the daughter, who is described in as observing the combat. The demon is described, of course, differently in the Persian epic, which is to be expected because the Sogdian artist and of the 8th century and the Persian poet of the Persian poet of the 11th century, of course, imagined this demon differently. Faramarz rescues the girl, the princess, the daughter of the king of Kahila, and later marries her. And what is also important and interesting that in the Faramarzname, his wife accompanies Faramarz on his travels, is mentioned with him, and probably also joined him during his journey home and visit to Khosrow. And after the return to India, she gave birth to a son called Borzin Adar. Now, this is the story from the longer Faramarzname. The shorter Faramarzname contains a different version of the story, but which also involves Faramarz killing a certain Kanas Div who had abducted three daughters of the Indian king Nowshad. So we see that the version in the narrative in both poems is different, but both involve the motif of Faramarz rescuing a princess captured by princesses captured by Div. Apparently, it was a very important and central story, very popular one about Faramarz, and this is why it occupies probably a central place also in on our paintings. Curiously, this princess, daughter of the king of Kahila, plays a much important role in the paintings in Sogdian version than in the in the Faramarzname. In Faramarzname, she's mentioned, but only occasionally. And here, this is the main story, and she features prominently. Now, for the two or three words about the particular iconography of this demon. As I mentioned, the details they come from India. Usually, in Penjikent, demons are not multi-headed. And I think that, and they do not have tridents and weapons. And I think it is clear here that the iconography of this particular demon is much more Indian, it exhibits much more Indian elements. And I think this is because the Sogdian artist tried to depict not any demon, but particularly an Indian demon. And this is why he employed here elements coming from the Indian iconography. So it was a well thought intention of the Sogdian artist here. Now the next scene, of course, shows after the Faramarz saved the daughter of the king of Kahila. The scene shows the Sistanian hero and his wife returning to Sistan, according to Faramarzname, and being greeted by Rustam, to whom Faramarz paid homage. This mountain is a very interesting detail. Marshak interpreted it as the border between border of the demon country, of the land of the demons. Faramarz returning from the hero returning from the land of the demons. I think that this mountain rather represents the Hindu Kush mountains between India and Sistan, and this was the intention of the Sogdian painter to show that Faramarz actually returns from India to Sistan, where he is being greeted by his father Rustam, who later escorts him to the court. to the King Khosrow court. Now, and here the last episode is, of course, the easiest one. Faramarz is being greeted by King Khosrow. We will discuss several elements of the representations of the king. But before that, interesting. I have a few words to say about Faramarz and about the representation of Faramarz as a hero in these paintings, because there are several things that I don't understand. Usually in Penji Kent, according to Marshak, heroes are depicted in profiles. Heroes and often also demons involved in combat. This is how Rustam is always depicted in the Blue Hall. Marshak even coined the term heroic profile for this type of depiction. Now, unlike Rustam, who was probably exceptional, the representations of Faramarz are deprived of any individuality. He's shown as an ordinary Sogdian warrior, not always in profile, here in profile, but not always. And this is, of course, a major distinction between him and Rostam. Still, there is one individual feature very interesting and specific for Faramarz. You can see here the decoration of his helmet in the shape of animal. Ears, which are completely unusual for depiction of humans in Penji Kent, because as a rule, animal traits in Penji Kent paintings are exclusively associated with demons. So it is very interesting why he has this animal ears. Or you can see it here, it's probably also the depiction of Faramarz, although the shape of the helmet is different here. And the only other representation of an important character with animal ears is found with the deity from the ossuary from Hirmantepahi. You can see this deity with animal ears. Also in Shahristan and in Ustrushana, we have at least two characters who appear to be ordinary warriors, but they have this kind of wing-like decoration on the helmet. Yes, here you can see it very clearly, and here too from Ustrushana. Usually, you do not see such depictions, and especially with animal ears. What does it mean? I suggested that this could be a hint to demonic ancestry of Faramarz, because as we all know, Rustam was related through his mother to a demon king Zahak. Another important attribute of Faramarz in his paintings is, of course, his red horse. Let me check if I have it in color. Yeah, you can see it here, and you can see it also parts of it here. His horse is always red, and I think that it's another attribute that points to Faramarz belonging to the house of Rustam, to the Sistani heroes, who probably in Penjikent paintings, and we have several characters like that in other in other epic circles, and this is probably why one of their attributes, the red horses. Now we have discussed a particularly Indian looks of the demon. I think that there is another element here which is particularly Indian and points into this direction, and this is the unusual throne of the king. In the Faramarsnamé, there is an interesting episode where Faramarz kills a giant bird. He makes an unusual throne out of its bones and sends it to Ran, to Kehusro, who apparently likes the throne that much, so that he turns it into his favorite throne. This throne is unusual because we have figures of elephants as a support. They are not found, elephants as supports of the throne are not found again with other royal images in Penjikent. We have one divine image on terracotta where a deity sits on a throne with elephant supports, but never in the paintings. And I think that perhaps this also the depiction of elephants, which were of course a symbol of India for the Sogdians, is also intentional and they're shown here in order to depict Kehusro as a supreme sovereign, as a king of India, because Faramarz returns from his Indian campaign with his princess to receive from Kehusro the Indian kingship. Now, instead of the conclusions, I would like to discuss two particular iconographic elements here in these paintings. One is the depiction of the king, which is again unusual for Sogdian royal depictions. This particular scene is unparalleled in Sogdian art and is more reminiscent of Sasanian prototypes, but by which it was probably inspired. Because other Sogdian royal images are different and show rulers in a much more modern entourage. The pose is definitely Sogdian, but the entourage and the setting of the scene is much more elaborate than we usually find with the Sogdian princes. And this arrangement with the pillows and the king surrounded by all his court is typical of Sasanian royal representation. The usual scenes of Sogdian kings are much more modest. Here you can see an image of the king seated on a royal chair. This is typical royal representation of the Sogdian king from Penjikent. You can see that he sits without the royal cushions and on the carpet, on much more than modest tacht, and he is on the same level with other people. It of course has a lot to do with a particular unique structure of the Sogdian society, which I mentioned at the beginning, where these lords were not absolute monarchs of Sasanian type, but they were rather viewed by the Sogdian nobles and rich merchants as primi inter pares, and these lords were actually elected from the same milieu. And here you can have as a comparison an image of the Sasanian king. So again, I think that it is an which is much closer to what we see with Kay Husrow in Penjikent. Only, of course, the pose is different, and I take it as an additional evidence that in this case, the Sogdian artist intended to depict a specifically Persian, not Sogdian king, because he knew that Kay Husrow is the king of Iran. Of course, he still has the most important Sogdian element of kingship in this time, and this is the axe, and the posture is Sogdian, and his general pose is much more expressive than the heraldic postures of the Sasanian kings. Well, the closest prototypes for these depictions, they come from south, from Bactria, and here you can see the so-called Klimova plate, which depicts a moon god Ma, identified by a moon crescent behind his back, as a king, and this is the closest parallel the depiction of Kay Husrow in Penjikent. But the most important thing is his likeness to a Sasanian prototype. And I will take 5 more minutes to comment upon another interesting element, and it is the nimbus. Perhaps I should go back where we can see the whole paintings, especially on the western wall. Yep. Well, several characters here, they have a nimbus, it is very interesting because it is the only case that I know of in Iranian art at all that the nimbus here is not static, but it is actually dynamic, and we can see a change here. Usually we have deities or kings represented with nimbi in a very static heraldic pose, scholars always argue what does nimbus mean. People usually talk about nimbus as a representation of Hvarna, far, the idea of royal divine glory in Zoroastrian religion, but we have for the pre-Islamic Iran, we have no textual evidence connecting far with nimbus or with light radiating from the body. It is only found in the Islamic period. And here it is very interesting because three characters here, they have nimbus, but they do not always have nimbus. The girl, the princess, she has a nimbus in the first scene, but she seems to lose it then she dismounts, and it's difficult to understand what does it mean and why. The demon has nimbus in the first two scenes, but loses it, then he is defeated. Here it's easier to understand why he loses the nimbus, because, well, he is defeated, and it is clear that nimbus stands for some kind of transcendental inner power. But why the girl loses the nimbus, it is not clear. The king, Kay Husrow, of course, has this nimbus, then he is in front. So, first of all, we see from this story that nimbus can be lost. It cannot be acquired. We do not see somebody acquire a nimbus in process of the narrative. And my original thought was that it can be related to the royal nature of the characters. and to indicate that they are of royal blood. The girl is, of course, a princess, the king is a king, and the demon is king of demons. But this does not explain why the girl loses her nimbus here in the scene of the fighting. Yeah, when here, then she's dismounted. Rustam never has a nimbus, which is also interesting. Why? He's definitely the most powerful hero, and if nimbus represents power and Varna and glory and whatever, one would expect to find Rustam with a nimbus. What else? He is also royalty. He is the ruler of Sistan. So why not? And Faramarz here is, of course, depicted without nimbus. So my idea, of which I'm not very fond of, is that, well, because the main difficulty is why the girl loses the nimbus here, because perhaps the Sogdian, yeah, she loses her nimbus once Faramarz is depicted with her in the same scene. Perhaps the painter felt uncomfortable to depict her with nimbus in the same scene with Faramarz, who is without nimbus, because on all later scenes, and you have seen, she's clearly subordinated to him. She stands behind, she's smaller, so maybe he felt a little bit uncomfortable. But thinking again, I would serve this issue just by giving Faramarz himself a nimbus, and that's all. And so I do not have any answers, and if you have any ideas about nimbus, I would like to hear it. And yeah, just one last word about the nimbus, which is very important element. The nimbus, the plain nimbus, appears for the first time in Iranian world. It is first depicted with deities on the coins of the Kushan king Kanishka in the 2nd century, and his successor king Huvishka for the first time creates an image of himself with a plain nimbus. Yeah, he takes it for his own image, for his own royal image. And the Kushan Empire was, of course, empire where the Buddhist and the Hindu iconography was formed in this period, and nimbus was quickly adopted by Buddhist and Hindu religious iconography. It spread into also into Christian iconography and into Iranian one, but the ultimate origin is of the plain nimbus is Central Asian, and these paintings I think hold the clue for understanding the meaning of image of nimbus, at least for the Sogdian society, because we should be careful not to not to combine everything, because the meaning of the nimbus in Panjikent in the 8th century was perhaps almost probably not the same as it was in Bactria in the 2nd century. But these paintings are the only place where we can see the dynamism and the dynamics of nimbus, or nimbus in motion, as we can call it. So. I think I should stop here to leave some time for discussion, and thank you very much.